For the holiday season that's in it, this is August after all, our panel brings you their pick of novels, songs and films that can transport you to another time and place, preferably somewhere warm and sunny. I'm joined by Adele Coffey, John Maher and John Maguire. I'm going to start with you, Adele, and with books. It's how I like to transport myself. Where are we going for your first choice? What's the book?
Sure, look, there's so many places, but I'm taking you down to deepest, darkest Cornwall with Rebecca, one of my all-time favourite novels by Daphne du Maurier, published in 1938. I think most people probably know the story by now. It's been adapted many times for film, but it is about a young woman who meets a very wealthy man on a cruise and he asks her to marry him. He's a widower. She goes to his beautiful house in Cornwall, it's called Manderley, and from the very first page, you're arriving into that house, up that drive with the sinister, intimidating rhododendrons, and it's just like the atmosphere created by this place and by this house is, it's unparalleled. It's kind of, I suppose, Wuthering Heights would be up there too, but it creates this sense of doom, of dread, and there's almost like the landscape is watching what's happening. It's almost like it knows the sea is crashing, the cliffs are wild, rugged. It's almost like there's this presence of the landscape and it knows what's happening. And it seems like at times it's trying to warn this young woman who's the second wife of Max de Winter.
I definitely don't want to escape to Manderley. I never did when I read the book. Except the France sections earlier on. I can get behind that. But it is incredibly evocative in terms of place.
It is. And actually, it would make you want to visit Cornwall, I think, because, you know, how it's... Daphne du Maurier lived there. She had a mansion quite like Manderley. It was called Menabilly. And she used to go there to write her books. But you can sense that she loved the place in the way that it's evoked. But yeah, it is quite sinister and intimidating. But there's nothing wrong with escaping into a place that frightens you a little bit.
John, in terms of film, are you going to start with quiet, sinister, intimidating, any of those things?
No, Bright Sunshine. This is the thing about cinema, is a machine. Cinema is a machine designed to carry us somewhere else in space and time. If films have the power, the well-made films have the power to transport us somewhere new and immerse us in a fictional world and escape our own lives for a couple of hours. And narrative transportation in films, when the experience of watching fires our imagination to the extent where it feels immersive and palpable and tactile. And it's not so much that we're carried along with the story or the plot, but it's how we respond to and absorb every element of the film in the entire, the production design, the cinematography, the costuming, the mise en scène, as the French would put it. And it's kind of a magic trick when it works. And it lets us not only see, but to feel places that we might never have been and might otherwise never experience, like the Antarctic or the jungles of Borneo or Tombstone in Arizona in 1872 or the surface of Mars 300 years from now. And when it works, it is uncanny at times. And we've all had that feeling when you come out of a film and you literally have to readjust to the real world and to your own life. And sometimes when it happens like that, it really is superb. And so my first pick, which is 1969, Los Angeles, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Tarantino's evocation of his own childhood. He would have been about 6 or 7 years old when this film is set. And he has, without the aid of CGI or computer compositing or any kind of special effect, he has used all the tricks in his arsenal, his cinematography, Robbie Richardson, his production design, the same team that he's worked with over and again, to recreate L.A. as it was in 1969, a tumultuous year in L.A. And I don't know if I need to explain the story. We have a fading movie star turned TV actor, Rick Dalton, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, his best friend and stunt double, Cliff Booth, played by Brad Pitt. The studio system of the golden age of Hollywood has come to an end. The counterculture is on the rise. These guys are struggling to find their place in a new world, a rapidly changing world. And they have to interact with real life figures like Steve McQueen, Bruce Lee, and most notably and fatefully, the actor Sharon Tate, played by Margot Robbie. And all of these stories intersect and coincide as the story moves towards that night that Charlie Manson and the family came calling. And it's that dark history that Tarantino rewrites as this epic fantasy, this heroic fantasy. But it is afterwards the place that we remember the most, I think. Not only the old recreated streets that Tarantino has rebuilt, the old cinemas, the buildings, the ranches up in Span Ranch, but it's the facsimiles of all of these places, because it's a movie about movies. That's really evocative as well. He's recreating the world twice. And that's a really clever trick. And it's that double evocation that draws out the essence of that changing era, the time, the place and the people.
And it is that thing I remember most about the film, having, I think I only saw it once, but it is a visually incredibly beautiful film, and it is very immersive.
Very immersive. You can literally smell the dust in the Californian air. You can feel it as you're walking through Span Ranch when they're on the horses up at Span Ranch where the family are hiding out, or when you're on the street, you're with Cliff Booth in the car. You can smell the diesel fumes, the petrol fumes when you're in the car. It really is Tarantino's best film, I think, his ninth film and his most personal film, but also his most complete film.
We have a clip from it. Let's have a little piece of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Who are you?
You can call me Mirabella.
Mirabella what?
Mirabella Lancer.
No, come on. What's your real name?
When we're on set, I prefer to only be referred to by my character's name. It helps me invest in the reality of the story. I've tried both ways, and I'm always just a tiny bit better when I don't break character. And if I can be a tiny bit better, I want to be.
What are you reading?
It's a biography on Walt Disney. It's fascinating. He's a genius, you know. I mean, a once in every 50 or 100 years kind of genius.
What are you, 12?
I'm 8.
That's John McGuire's first choice of a film for us today from Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. John Marr, music, that's something that can take us away with the space of a few notes.
Yeah, absolutely. Not just to place, but to a specific time as well. There's so many great moments that just transport us, you know. Even if you think of something like Bagatelle and Summer in Dublin, not a song I particularly adore, but it brings you to an Ireland and a Dublin that is gone to some degree. The Liffey, the way it can be in summertime, and the raggedness of the city as it was and perhaps still is. I went to Nashville in April, and a lot of Irish people are finding it easier to get there now because Aer Lingus are going direct, which is quite handy. And it's called Music City. That's how it's promoted by the tourist board there. And it really is obsessed by music, not just performers, but songwriters. And one of the things I did was went to a little club off the main drag of Broadway. And it's a club that is centred entirely on singer-songwriters themselves. You know, people that craft the tunes, but maybe are doing it for famous people like Zach Bryan and Taylor Swift, and they're getting their own chance to shine. And every time during that trip, I was thinking of a song that is so redolent of the dreams of a songwriter and a performer, and that's Rhinestone Cowboy, written in 1974 by Larry Weiss and recorded famously the following year by Glen Campbell. Mm-hmm. And it's impossible to walk through that very busy, popular party city and not think about it. There's a great line early on: I know every crack in these dirty sidewalks of Broadway. And yeah, they are dirty sidewalks. When I first arrived into the city, it was in the evening time, and I have never seen a street as packed with people, and traffic was barely moving. But the next day, I went for a walk quite early in the morning, and I had the place to myself. And I was thinking of all those kind of cracks on that sidewalk, and the songwriters that have walked down there for decades dreaming of writing something great, of writing a song that would change the world. And in so many respects, Rhinestone Cowboy captures that. Of course, Glen Campbell was already extremely well known at that stage.
I think we're going to take a little clip of it now, because it would seem a terrible tease not to. This is Glen Campbell. Yeah.
hustle's the name of the game. And nice guys get washed away like the snow and the rain. There's been a load of compromising on the road to my horizon. But I'm gonna be where the lights are shining on me. Like a rhinestone cowboy, riding out on a horse in a star-spangled rodeo. Like a rhinestone cowboy, getting cards and letters from people.
I think at this stage of the proceedings, it would be an awful shame if John Maguire didn't tell us what he's just told us as the song was playing. How much money did you make from that song?
10p. You'd get 10p from my granny. Granny Helen, Granny Ryan would give me 10p if I gave her a couple of bars of Rhinestone Cowboy on her kitchen floor.
Seems like a decent earner.
It wasn't bad. Yeah, there was a few other songs in the repertoire as well, but 10p was hard to come by in the late 1970s.
Who knows what we'll come to later on. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena, and we're talking about the art that can transport you to another time and place. Adele, your next choice is the novel The Lost Daughter by Elena Ferrante. So where does that take us and when?
Yeah, it takes us to the southern coast of Italy, despite the fact that the film adaptation takes us to Greece. I had to double check that. But this is, it's a very transportational novel in terms of both the place it takes you to and also in terms of the emotions and the feelings. Obviously, Elena Ferrante is very well known for her Neapolitan series and My Brilliant Friend books. But this one is a very slim little novel called The Lost Daughter, and it's about this woman called Lida who her daughters are grown up and they've gone to spend some time with their father who lives in Canada, and she decides, okay, I'm going to be lonely, so I'll take this little trip. I'll go on a holiday to a beach, I would like to add, a wonderful, sunny, beautiful beach. And when she gets there, she sort of realises actually she's not as lonely as she thought she would be, and she has this sense of liberation from motherhood. So it's a very interesting novel in that sense. It looks, as all Elena Ferrante's novels do, it looks at womanhood and motherhood very closely, I think, and the sort of duality of emotions that I think parents can feel. But also how the place is described, the oppressive heat is really strongly evoked in the novel. And even, again, it's back to all the senses, isn't it? All the smells that she describes, you know, there's eucalyptus bark, there's pine cones cracking. And really the heat is the... It's so oppressive. And when she goes back to her little apartment at the end of each day as well, that also evokes a sense of place, a very strong sense of place too. And it feels like she's almost trapped and claustrophobic. But yeah, it's just, it evokes those days of kind of endless sort of boredom sometimes when you're on a beach. I know other people feel differently about beaches. Maybe you'll agree with me here. Sometimes I just feel like it's a very long, boring time on a beach, but she really gets that very well. But the oppressive heat, the sense of being in a place that you don't know, that you're not from and that you're sort of unfamiliar with, is very well evoked here.
Beaches are a black hole full of things I don't care to do. It's just I've got nothing. Now, thankfully, we've had
a beach bashing on this program so far.
There's plenty more to come where that came from. Thankfully, John Maguire, your next film choice gives us the best possible contrast in that we're going to Minnesota.
Icy cold, yeah. This is the Coens. The Coens are the masters of place. You think of the vast desert in No Country for Old Men or the Mississippi Delta of Oh Brother Where Art Thou, or the small town suburbs of The Man Who Wasn't There. The greatest achievement in that skill, and they work very hard at it, is their evocation of the bone-chilling cold of a Minnesota winter in the pitch-black police procedural Fargo, which is titled after a fictional town. And where we come over the course of the story, a beautifully plotted story, but we come to know this place. We know the geography of it, the climate, the people, the social classes, the customs, the accents, their love of hockey, their how they communicate with one another. And there's also this kind of the demeanor of the people, how they will say anything straight to your face in the nicest possible way. This kind of almost, it's not fake nice, it's Minnesota nice is what they call it, where they're like Canadians, ineffably polite, absolutely polite, but they're discussing some of the most horrible things. A guy gets thrown into a wood chipper, just as if, for instance, a woman gets kidnapped and murdered. And so the Coens are native Minnesotans, and they conjure this kind of portrait of the place. I'm not going to go through the story of the plot. We've got Frances McDormand as a policewoman who's 7 months pregnant. There's a crooked kidnapper played by William H. Macy. He's a car dealer. And a ruthless killer who's played by Steve Buscemi. And it plays out in the middle of nowhere, which is a place, as Adele will know from books, as we know from music and art, a place where a lot of things can happen, is this kind of isolation. And as with all the Coens films, it's that accretion of detail and nuance that anchor the film's sense of place. It's the snow and ice are a given, I suppose, but the state itself is... It's their tribute to where they're from, and that's the starring role. If you count the number of references to ice hockey or landscape artists or the dialogue about landmarks, this Paul Bunyan statue pops up now and again in Brainerd. And it is after the film, you feel like you've been there. You wouldn't want to be there for the events of the film.
No, very much
but
so.
But you really feel that you've come out of the film learning something about a place in America that is not fashionable, that is not Los Angeles or New York, that is not the subject of stories or books or art. And you come away from it thinking that you've visited the real America in this hyper-realistic story.
You've teed me up beautifully, John Maher. Your next song is about New York.
It very much is. Empire State of Mind, Jay-Z featuring Alicia Keys, Jay-Z from Brooklyn, Alicia Keys from the Hell's Kitchen neighbourhood of Manhattan. And I think anybody, when they first go to New York, you're just swept up by just the scale of the place, the height of the buildings, the fact, John talks about the evocative nature of movies. We feel like we've been to New York when the first time we arrived there. So much of it is so familiar. And Empire State of Mind just captures the majesty of a city as sprawling and wondrous as it. A concrete jungle where dreams are made of, these streets will make you feel brand new. It mentions so many aspects of all the different boroughs, Brooklyn, Tribeca, Broadway, there's a Yankees game. And it's quite thrilling. A couple of Brooklyn songwriters originally kind of conceived the demo for this and sent it to Roc Nation. And Jay-Z was decidedly unimpressed at first, thought, this isn't for me. But one of his label mates said, you need to listen to this. And he did. And it was released in 2009 and just was so critically acclaimed. And what's fantastic about a crossover song like this is that his rap is superb, but Alicia Keys' contribution is absolutely glorious as well.
So uplifting, actually, that song, isn't
so
it?
So uplifting.
When I
really
listen to
is.
It, I feel like I'm in a better mood instantly.
Yeah, and it still sounds so fresh 16 years on.
Yeah, again, I hate to tease people without actually giving them a little something of what they're looking for. So let's play some of Jay-Z, Alicia Keys. State of Mind here on Arena on RTE Radio 1. We are looking at books, at films and music that transport us and take us elsewhere. Adele, a book I don't know by an author I don't know. We're going tropical next.
Francesca Segal. I had actually never read any of her books before until I came across this Welcome to Gloria's Tuga, which is the first part in a three-part series you'll be pleased to hear, because this is so beautiful. It's about this young woman who is a vet, I think, or she goes to the island to become a vet. She's a researcher, and she's sort of running away from her life in London, where her mother is this sort of ball-breaking barrister, and she grew up thinking she had no father, that her father had abandoned her. her, but actually she finds out that her mother never bothered telling her father that she was pregnant or that she existed. So she goes to this island sort of under the guise of getting away, but also in the hope of discovering a few things about her origins. And the island is, it's made up, it's Tuatha De Oro, but it's the most beautiful, nostalgic, like perfectly imagined tropical island where, you know, there's... You can't escape it. You can't actually get away only at certain times of the year. So certain produce comes in at certain times of the year. And for the rest of the year, you're stuck there with the community and the turtle called Martha. And I know that sounds a little bit, I don't know, twee, but it's really not. It's as enjoyable as any sort of romantic comedy you've ever read. But also it's got lots of wonderful insights about identity, community, without bashing you over the head about them. So the second one is out now. It's called Island Calling, I should say. And I can't wait to read the third one.
Okay. John McGuire, I was thrilled when I saw the list of films that we were going to talk about coming in. And this in particular, because I only saw this a couple of weeks ago, it's been re-released for the 25th anniversary.
Yeah, it's usable 4K.
It is
remastered.
Stunning to look at. It's Wong Kar-wai in the Mood for Love.
In the Mood for Love, yeah. Sure, your heart would swoon just even hearing the title of it. This Wong Kar-wai in the late 90s and early 2000s was one of the preeminent world filmmakers. His films were very highly anticipated. This is one part of a trilogy, a loosely connected trilogy of romances that he made. And it is set in 1962 in Hong Kong and is a very specific snapshot of that city at that time, the streets, the food, the people, that strange and constant chaos of a port city that's caught between two empires, the fading British and the rising Chinese at that specific time. So we're going to put the costuming to one side because we'd be here all day into that, because these people are immaculately dressed. And the story follows a man played by Tony Leung and a woman played by Maggie Cheung in a stitch-perfect early 1960s. They both discover... They're friends, they live in the same apartment building, and they discover that their spouses are both are having an affair with each other. And as they spend more time together in a platonic relationship, they gradually develop feelings for one another. But their relationship, it's that tantalizing thing, is just slightly out of reach, just there around the next corner. So the film is a reflection on love and loss, and it's achingly tender in the way that Wong Kar-wai was so expert at evoking. But it is utterly immersive in how it recreates a lost time and place. And he's working with a tiny, tiny budget with some of the most skilled filmmakers in the region, particularly his cinematographer, Christopher Doyle. And they use every trick in the book to turn this modern city-state into an earlier era and to evoke a place that is lost and gone forever.
And that is In the Mood for Love. It may still be in a couple of cinemas around the country.
It is available in plenty of places. It's one to watch, and the whole trilogy is really worth watching.
Okay, John Marr, another song. Where are we going next?
We're going to 1967, Swing 60s London, Waterloo Sunset, one of the great, great songs of that decade from the Kinks. And bizarrely, was originally going to be titled Liverpool Sunset. And then Penny Lane arrives and Ray Davies decides, no, we should set this in London. It's wonderful because anybody who's walked along the Thames in the heart of that city, and of course the Thames flows so magnificently through it, there's just so many evocative sights all around. And the again, that line that really roots it in a specific time, Terry meets Julie, a reference to Terence Stamp and Julie Christie, you know, two of the great stars of the 1960s. And Waterloo Station, which perhaps is not the most romantic place in the world, but it's this idea that you can kind of find beauty no matter where you look.
As long as I gaze on Waterloo. sunset time.
Terry meets Julie, Waterloo Station.
Ray Davies and the Kinks, of course, there with Waterloo Sunset. Thank you, Trasa in Galway, for the text. She says, Rick, you played Rhinestone Cowboy. As a small child, I couldn't understand why the man on the radio was getting carrots and lettuce in the post from people he didn't even know. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena, and we're talking about art that transports us with Adele Coffey, John Maguire and John Marr. Adele, we're going to your final book for this evening. It is Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver. You've made your choice. Off you go.
I have made my choice because I do think that Barbara Kingsolver evokes place so well in Demon Copperhead. Now, I'm sure there's very few people left in the world who have not read this book if you're a fan of books. It won the Pulitzer Prize. I think it won the Women's Prize and lots of other prizes too, I'm sure. But it was Barbara Kingsolver's take on David Copperfield by Charles Dickens. So, you know, pretty ambitious project, but I think she succeeded wonderfully. It was one of the most absorbing escapist reads I've ever come across, despite the fact that, yes, it does deal with poverty and it does deal with the opioid crisis in America. But where it's set is Lee County, Virginia. So it's kind of specific to the Appalachian sort of area. And it really just from page one evokes this, you know, very rural setting, but she uses all the details of the culture, of the community, of where Demon Copperhead is born in a single wide, as they call it, in a trailer. And even things like at one point he goes to work in a, he's fostered and he goes to work in a tobacco field or a tobacco farm. And her descriptions of that was just, again, so transportative. You feel like you're actually there and you learn so much. Like, who knew that you could actually be poisoned by picking tobacco leaves if you're a child?
It is not all misery though as well, because there's great warmth.
So much misery, I feel. I used to listen to the Smiths when I was 15. What can I say?
But there's great warmth and there's great humour in parts of the book as well.
Oh, yes. It's this character you will fall in love with. And I should say there is great warmth. There is great humour. Lots of humour. And if you think about David Copperfield, it is optimistic in the end. And it's all about survival and it's about love and it's about who your family are, whether they're blood related or not. It doesn't really matter. It is optimistic in the end.
Okay, John Maguire, you're giving us a staycation for your final choice. What have you chosen?
This is That They May Face the Rising Sun. This is Pat Collins' 2024 film, adapted from the novel by the great poet of the Irish landscape, John McGarren. This is Collins evoking a very specific corner of Leitrim at a very specific time and as a place, I suppose, of unchanging ritual and culture and nature and geography. It's a story of returning immigrants being reabsorbed and contributing to a community, and it unfolds under the mountains and around a lake, the lake being the central character, I suppose, certainly in the novel and in the film, even though most of the film is actually shot in Galway. Pat didn't let a lot of people know that at the time, but this is a part of the country that people don't go to. They don't really go to Leitrim. They don't really go to McGarren country, but they absolutely should, because it is some of the most stunning landscape that we've got. And Collins captures that isolation, but that codependency that the people have between the land and the community. And the land will always be there. There's certainly an ancient feel to some of the elements of this film. So there's a moment when Joe is played by Barry Ward. He's walking with a neighbour down an old path, and the path could be medieval. I mean, it certainly feels like it could be medieval. And they're under this granite mountain, and he nods at the mountain, and it's a joke. He says, it's still there. And of course it's still there. It's been there since the glacier retreated 10,000 years ago, and it will be there 10,000 years from now. And that moment in time that spans so far one way and so far another way is such a delicate thing to capture on in film. It's really hard on the page, But then to transpose that to film is such a delicate thing to do. And Collins does that throughout this film. He has these moments that feel timeless, even though he is being very specific in his time as the late 70s, the early 1980s, a time of economic deprivation, emigrants mostly leaving, some people are returning, at a time when a guy with a pencil and a copybook would sit in an attic and say, I'm going to be a writer. And the community that's around him of predominantly elderly men and women who know how to felt wool, who know how to make honey, who know how to thresh hay, all of these skills that are lost. And his evocation of time is one thing, but place is another. And it's that eternality of the landscape is something that's so delicate and so beautiful.
Finally, John Maher, one more song. You get to finish us out. What's it going to be?
We're heading to Paris and via Irish Eyes. It's Parisian Walkways from 1979, the song that Gary Moore co-wrote with Phil Innett. In so many respects, it's legendary for that weeping guitar that Moore plays so beautifully in studio. And while the lyrics are scant, it really captures a sense of, I suppose, what everybody loves about Paris, which is cafe culture and just losing yourself on the streets. I mean, I adore city breaks, and they don't come much better than Paris, where you feel that you can just lose yourself in various enclaves, and there are so many neighbourhoods there. And just a beautiful lyric here written by the great Phil. The Champs-Élysées, Saint-Michel and old Beaujolais wine, those summer days spent outside corner cafes. He's talking there about the Latin Quarter's Place Saint-Michel, gorgeous part of Paris. And it's just so evocative. And every time I hear this song, I think how much I'd love to be back there, maybe about to head in for steak frites or a lovely glass of Beaujolais or just a cup of coffee and a croissant. And it is evocative, as all great songs about cities should be.
Art historian Jess Fahey is also here. Jess, you're going to be telling us about the Irish artists who made their lives in sunnier places and were inspired by their surroundings. But before we talk about the artists and their locations, can you tell us a little bit about how and when artists began to travel and work abroad? How did that come about?
So essentially, we kind of think about artists traveling for study. So we could go back even to the medieval period where they would have, you know, apprenticeship followed by a journeyman time and then masterwork. But as we kind of get it more and more from the time of the Renaissance into the classical world, most people take a sort of journey heading for Rome. And that seems to then influence a lot of artists in terms of their subjects. But what you're talking about is when we get to the 19th century, when all of a sudden there is greater transport, you can take the train, you can have a pre-made, pre-primed canvas that you bring with you. You now have oil paints that come in a little tube, like toothpaste tube. So it completely changes the way that artists get to travel. So now they can bring their supplies with them wherever they go, and they can do that on holiday, they can do that in artists' colonies, and they can do it in cities too. But it means that we're opening up to much more choice of subject and much more inspiration for artists.
And one of the first places where artists start to gather is a town in France called Barbizon. Why Barbizon? Why is that so popular?
So it's essentially due to trains. There was a train there from Paris. And the first sort of group of artists that go there include people like Corot and Millet. People would know Millet from the very famous Angelus painting. And they were looking for what they essentially termed realist subjects. So they weren't interested in painting the classical world or mythology, religious subjects. They wanted to celebrate the real. And this becomes a sort of philosophy as well as an artistic interest. So they want to find the perfect peasants, which we might now find a little problematic as a thing to be seeking
out. Just a little.
But once they were there, they also realised that there were these beautiful villages and forests, and they started to seek out part of what they understood as a sort of essence of French identity. And you mentioned Paul Henry earlier. He did exactly that, looking for that in the west of Ireland. So it's not just something that happens in France, but arguably starts there. So then from that time, we start to find that artists realise that the real isn't just the peasant life, but the real can also be their own personal life, which is how you get people like Monet and the Impressionists celebrating kind of bourgeois afternoons on the Seine and things like that.
And Irish artists start to gather in parts of France as well. Where does that happen?
So the first to go to Barbizon is Nathaniel Hone the Younger, and he's there around 1857. And he was very much inspired again by that idea of looking for a new type of art. And you can see how ultimately the sort of artist colony grows up around these artists with these new ideas and new ways of painting. But it was also cheaper to live there. And you also then had a whole community of artists who were interested in what you were doing. You could share ideas. So over time in that area, Fontainebleau Forest, other places, you get other people like Frank O'Mara. He's particularly associated with a place called Grey Sir Long. Frank O'Mara was from Carlow, had ultimately a very short career, but he was very influential in that artist colony where people like John Singer Sargent would show up. And there's a fantastic painting in the National Gallery of an artist on the bridge of Grey Sir Long, painted by John Lavery, who painted that actual bridge from about 10 different angles in his times there. But we believe that it's Frank O'Mara, the figure on the bridge. And he's leaning very nonchalant in his very famous sort of Irish tweeds that he would wear, glancing across at a young girl leaning over the bridge, while her chaperone clearly looks a little annoyed by this interaction. And what I love about it is it gives us that insight into what it must have been like to live in Grey Sir Long. And all of a sudden, you know, it could be 50, 100 of these young artists would come in the summer and move into the area and ask, you know, would you sit for a portrait to all of these locals? And I suppose a little bit of that kind of fetishizing of them as well. But there was a great sense of community, camaraderie, all of this in the area.
Yeah, do we know what the locals made of this? Were they taken by this? Were they furious at the idea of their towns being invaded by these people every summer?
For the most part, it does seem to be good for the economy, as we would note elsewhere. But there was definitely a few raised eyebrows about the morals of these young men in particular coming in their droves. And there aren't as many women who tend to do the same sort of travel at this time. A great Irish example is Helen Mabel Trevor, but she was older and independently wealthy. And also travelled with her sister. But it is a group of young lads basically painting around small villages in France.
Plus ça change. Many Irish people, they're lucky enough to travel on the ferry to Brittany every summer. It's been a source of inspiration for many artists, Irish ones included.
Yes, absolutely. So in particular, when we think of Brittany, we think of Pont-Aven. And Pont-Aven being also sort of considered a school. But when we talk about Pont-Aven as a school, we're really talking about a group of artists that's surrounded Paul Gauguin, and he was there from about 1886 onwards. And of course, the famous Irish artist in relation to that is Roderick O'Connor, claimed to be descendant from the last High Kings of Ireland, so quite an interesting pedigree. And he would have been one of these sort of followers or surrounders of Gauguin. And Gauguin was coming up with ideas of thinking about how, although you can be inspired by what's around you, you're actually taking that and filtering it through your own imagination. So they come up with a few different types of stylistic changes. Cynicism is one of them that is probably best known, where things appear very flat, almost like as if they're painting as if it's stained glass. So they're paring things down to just form and colour and creating really quite a unique new way of painting that isn't an illusionistic window onto the world. It really changes how we think about art and what we think the potential for an artist's choices to be.
I'm fascinated by Mary Swansea and by her story because it is one that people might not necessarily know. Tell us a little bit about her.
It's an absolutely extraordinary story when you really think about it. So she was born in Dublin and managed to convince her father to let her study in Paris. So she's in Paris around 1903. There were a few other examples like Sarah Purser, who her father knew, who'd been there back in the 1870s. So there was a bit of precedent for women to do it. But even that wasn't enough for her. And even at that point, she knew people like Picasso and hang out at Gertrude Stein's salon and things like that. But then when her father dies and she inherits some money, her and her sister first go to Eastern Europe and they're doing some aid after the First World War, and she paints around Czechoslovakia, places like that. And then she writes to relatives of hers in Honolulu. And she manages to get all the way there, only to write to Sarah Purser saying, it's not exotic enough. I need more. I need something else. And this is a woman unmarried. We're talking about the 1920s. This is very unusual for someone to have this sort of bravery. And she then goes to Samoa. So 2,600 miles she travels, goes to Samoa and paints some of the most extraordinarily beautiful, really immersive scenes of jungle life. And in particular, for her, she's very much a bystander watching. She doesn't sort of enforce herself on the environment as Gauguin would do in Tahiti, for example. But there's a really beautiful work from this period in the Crawford, which shows just how lush and interesting it was. So if you think about that in the time we're thinking of, to go from Dublin all the way to the other side of the world to do this for your own artistic interest, when really, as she said, you know, she didn't have that much attention given to her, because she said if she'd born Henry rather than Mary, things would have been very different. But she was sort of, you know, sidelined, even though she was doing things as adventurous and exciting as the male artists.
Eileen Gray is somebody whose work I've been obsessed with for a very, very, very long time, possibly since the first time I came across her, the room in Collins Barracks. Tell us about her and about the life she made on the Côte d'Azur.
So her, you know, again, life story is very similar in the sense that she was in Paris in 1903 and then ends up moving there permanently in 1906, sets up a design shop. But over time, her design becomes increasingly, increasingly modern and increasingly functional, where form follows function. And she decides that she's going to make the perfect holiday home for herself down in Roquebrune, down in the south of France. And the whole house is built with the concept of it being glass fronted so that every room has a view of the sea. So an extraordinary idea, and something that I think we can all imagine ourselves being there and how glorious that would be. But it was a very modern new way of designing, and it was very unique and interesting. But extraordinarily, it's often the interior that really is the thing that we need to champion her for, because other architects at the time were building with similar, you know, concepts on the exterior, but they weren't integrating every part of design. So she would have certain armchairs that were made for those who leaned on their left elbow while reading, or her sister really liked breakfast in bed. So there's a particular table she built that would swing around that would work really well for that function. And this is where we start to get one of the most famous stories around her life, which is, although she lived there with one of her partners, after they break up, she gives the house to her partner, her ex-partner that point, and Le Corbusier, who'd stayed before, comes to stay often. And of course, he's being famed at the time for being the greatest modern architect, but he hasn't yet figured out how to do interiors. So he arrives, and rather than just, you know, ask for her advice or follow her example, he, in the nude, paints erotic images all over her pristine, minimalist white walls, which was a real desecration of the building, only to ultimately end up being the reason it was saved, because then people thought he'd built it or designed it. And that's why it managed to be saved, because, as I'm sure you know, Eileen Gray wasn't as well known.
I certainly remember the last time I was in the south of France, and it's been quite some time, the house wasn't yet open to the public. Can people visit now?
Yes, you can. Yeah, you'd have to apply in advance, as far as I know, and it has sort of odd opening hours, but yes, you can definitely visit.
But well worth the trip.
Oh, absolutely.
And my thanks to Jess Fahey and all my other panellists tonight, Adele Coffey, John Marr and John McGuire. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena, and I'm joined now by Arena's series producer, Sinead Egan.
Thanks, Rick. I just wanted to take a moment on air this evening to thank everybody for their messages of sympathy and support, which we've received over these last days. We've received messages to the show, emails, calls, texts, but also cards and even mass cards. And we're going to be sending these on to Sean's family. It really meant so much to us that listeners got in touch with us just to tell us how much they appreciated Sean and how much they're going to miss him. We're all going to miss him so much. We wanted to end the show tonight with a piece of music from a group called Lá na Hoige. In April of last year, three members of that group, Cathal Ó Cuarán and sisters Moira and Eitéonnú Chuireann, were in studio with us, and you'll understand why we chose that piece when you hear it. But before that, the poet Éilis Ní Gaoimhne went into our studio in Ballynongal in County Kerry earlier today to record this poem that she wrote about Sean and Arena during the pandemic.
Dinner with Sean Rocks. A year ago, I started having dinner with Sean Rocks. I light the candles, pour a glass of wine, and set my plate upon the table. Then Arena starts. Imagine turning up for an interview with that, he laughs. Novelists and singers. My favourites are the film critics, so blunt and honest. It's March. The dark locked garden calls for candles. After the clock springs on in April, they're not needed, but I persist. Dinner with Sean Rocks and candles lit at 7 every evening. It's March again. A year has passed, the year of COVID. I light the candles, set my plate upon the table, rice and chicken. I want to finish with something I know you love. You know what I like about Sean Rocks? He's nice. He has a melodious voice. He's not pompous, never perky. He speaks decent Irish. Inis an nucht a leif nucht eg mora de valish, he says before the show begins. That's our lot for this evening. Much has happened since last March, birth and death, and yet. Tá sé díreach in am de John Creedon.
Listen, I could talk to you all night, but we better. I want to go to the last song that you had chosen for us, which is Slán Leat, which again brings us into the family connections here. Whose aunt was it that wrote this, Cathal?
So, Maeve Ní Bheagla's aunt, Eileen, escribed to her ancho, and it was to mourn someone who had passed in the family. I think it was her mother.
Her mother.
And it's a lovely fitting call song.
Beautiful sentiment, sentiment in it as well, you know, Gonairí an Bóthar Leat, that your road may rise before you.
Sinead.
So, Araig Libh. Slán Leat.
Gnáidí de Bóthar Leat, gnáidí de Bóthar Leat, gnáidí de Bóthar Leat, slán agus beannacht leat.
La Nehoige there with Slán Leat, which they performed live for Sean on Arena in April of last year. And before that, we heard Éilis Ní Guaibhne with her poem Dinner with Sean Rocks.